Hey, this is Ryan Joe, managing editor of AdExchanger. Join us January 23rd and 24th in New York City for AdExchanger's Industry Preview. We'll bring you two impactful days focused on what to expect in the next 12 months in marketing technology. Register today at industrypreview.com.
Welcome to AdExchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is supported by Neustar Marketing Solutions. The Neustar Identity DMP is the only DMP with built-in identity. Later in this episode, VP of Product Marketing, Alex LePage, will chat with AdExchanger about what still prevents marketers from achieving true people-based, customer-centric marketing, what makes an identity DMP superior to commoditized tech stacks, and why Neustar is the best-kept secret among top enterprise marketers.
Hey everyone, this is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of AdExchanger and your host. So programmatic is still growing really fast. In its October programmatic forecast, eMarketer predicted programmatic in digital display will grow from $47 billion in 2018 to $69 billion in 2020. The company also found very large shifts of budget to private deal structures. Here to talk with me about these findings and other findings is eMarketer's principal analyst, Lauren Fisher. Lauren is a brilliant observer of marketing trends, not only in programmatic, and she'll present her updated programmatic numbers and trends at AdExchanger's Programmatic I.O. San Francisco conference in April. Come and check her out there. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks, Zach. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you in the studio. I'm surprised we haven't done this yet.
I know.
Well, we're making up for lost time. Let's hear about you for a minute. You went to two Big Ten schools, I noticed from your LinkedIn.
I did.
Penn State and Ohio State. I went to University of Michigan.
Ah.
So we have very little to talk about.
I actually really like Michigan.
Oh, you do?
I do. So I would take Michigan over Ohio State.
Would you
really? I would.
Wow, you would lose that bet.
Yeah.
At least if we're talking about football. You studied journalism.
I did, yes.
Did you consider a career in journalism?
I did. It was a bit of a funny story when I got to Penn State. I had always somewhat been interested in journalism, but I was really looking to study Spanish.
Okay.
Before we got to the school, though, for freshman year, they sent the initial paperwork asking you to kind of pre-declare your major. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find Spanish on the paperwork. Maybe I didn't flip it over or look hard enough. So I kind of checked the journalism box thinking, oh, well, you know, I can change this at any time.
Yeah.
And once I got there, I ended up in a few classes and really enjoyed it. And I don't know if it was laziness or it was fate, but I stuck with journalism.
You did?
I did. I did double major in Spanish. So that was good that I went and, you know, did what I was hoping to do. But I really did enjoy journalism, especially at Penn State, the print side of things.
And then you entered the workforce, but did not do so as a journalist or a junior reporter somewhere.
It's correct. I started in the workforce at a B2B search engine called business.com as an online advertising editor.
Okay.
So essentially I was, you know, editing search ads.
Right. Got it. So eventually ended up living the analyst life. You've been doing that for a while. How long?
I've been with eMarketer for 8 years.
8 years. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, like being an analyst, was it something you set out to do or you landed there and it turned out to be an exciting environment?
I was with business.com for 5 years in a variety of capacities. I started as an editor, moved over to sales, spent some time in product, spent my last few years in the marketing department, and really liked content marketing. As I was searching for a new opportunity, I actually saw, of all things, a banner ad on LinkedIn for a position at eMarketer. I was familiar with eMarketer. We were a client of eMarketer, so I applied, and the rest is really history.
Wow.
Yeah.
When we think of eMarketer, many listeners will think of, oh, that's the research firm that puts out numbers on everything from like video viewing to programmatic ad spending, different channels, different marketing channels. I guess maybe it would be good to hear you talk a little bit about eMarketer, what it is and what its model is.
Sure. So at eMarketer, we're really looking at how digital is transforming media, marketing, and commerce. So in those three areas, we're looking at everything from virtual reality to video games. We're looking at everything from programmatic to voice assistance. So we're even looking at time spent with media. Mm-hmm. We're looking at consumer adoption patterns of different tools and technology. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we're looking at how much advertisers are investing in reaching consumers across all those various devices and tools and channels and formats.
Mm-hmm. And what's the business model for eMarketer?
We're a subscription business.
Subscription, right.
Yeah.
And are the customers marketers?
It runs the gamut. Okay. We have agencies, media companies, mm-hmm. we have brands, really anyone who is engaged in some form or fashion with digital marketing or okay. digital in general would be interested in an eMarketer subscription.
Got it. Okay, great. And talk a little bit about the research approach, because I know you've historically done a combination of sort of pulling data from a lot of different sources, including other research firms, as well as original surveys and research.
Yes.
So
still true. So we want to make sure that for our clients, we give them a very unbiased view of how the industry is unfolding. To do that, we're pulling in third-party information, research surveys, all of those things you just mentioned. We're gathering that information, but we're also vetting that information to make sure that it's methodologically sound, it makes sense, it matches with the perspective that we're seeing in the market. So we have that piece. We also have our own proprietary data, our forecasts that we're putting out, time spent with media, it could be ad spending, it could be device adoption. Again, if it's in media, marketing, or commerce, it's something we probably cover. And then we also have a qualitative component, which is what I largely focus on. And that's just explaining to our clients, what does all of this mean? Making sense of it for them. We have our newsletter where we do this in a short form. We have our podcast, but then we also have our long form reports where we're really trying to give our readers an understanding of what this means in terms of the trends, the challenges, and the opportunities.
Okay. All right. Great. When you think of your competitive set, who pops to mind first?
It depends on what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Research firms, we okay. often, hear Forrester, yeah. Gartner, those are popular ones. And then on the media side, sometimes it's other people who are covering the industry as well.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the October report.
Sure.
To start out. I'll give those numbers again. $47 billion last year.
Mm-hmm.
$69 billion next year. to start with, how would you define programmatic just for the purposes of this discussion?
Sure. So for that forecast, we're looking at programmatic digital display ad spend in the United States. So this is just for the U.S.
Yep.
We're defining programmatic as the use of automation in the buying, selling, or fulfillment of digital display ads.
Okay. And automation could be... It doesn't have to be a DSP bidding on open exchange inventory.
It doesn't.
Okay.
Oftentimes when we talk about programmatic, we're thinking about real-time bidding, exchanges, open market type buying. But this is a very broad definition that can include everything from that to just purely logging into an interface and, automating the buying process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So and what sources do you draw on to reach that estimate? For example, like the public market filings from companies like Google and Facebook?
So that's a great question. So in terms of the methodology for how we're developing our forecasts, mm-hmm. we do take a bottom-up approach. Typically, as you said, we are using the foundation of the forecast as what do some of these company revenues look like? Mm-hmm. The big players in the industry, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we build on top of that. For our forecast, we're looking again at what additional third-party research is out there. How do we standardize that and make sense of that in a collective way? what do we know about our conversations with people in the industry that help us to understand these numbers? And then we're using statistical modeling to basically come up with our number to understand whether, you know, how all of this fits together. It's interesting because all of our forecasts, especially the programmatic forecast is an example of this, kind of nest and fit within each other. We can't do the programmatic forecast, for example, without having our larger U.S. digital ad spend forecast. So as we're developing one forecast, we're always looking back to our baseline model and these prior forecasts to make sure that all those checks are in place so that if we're forecasting for mobile programmatic, that matches with what our larger forecast says for mobile overall. So, it's a pretty complex process.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
It sounds like as time goes by, your digital ad forecast and your programmatic forecast are going to start to look really similar. Just from the, I mean, according to this last report, 86% digital display is now programmatic.
It's true.
I mean, that other report is only off by 14%.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. So. And I think the interesting thing, too, with programmatic is when we start with that bottom-up model, 5 or 6 years ago when we built the forecast, you know, we didn't have programmatic numbers. We had numbers for our company revenues overall, but we really had to do the legwork and talk to people in the industry to understand, you know, what does that number look like for you? What percentage of your revenue is programmatic? Or if you're an advertiser, what percent of that ad spend is transacting programmatically? And so we do this every year where we're having all of these on-background conversations, again, to just double-check and make sure that our model matches what we're hearing with the market.
Okay, got it. So what's digital display?
It's a broad category. display is...
What's not display?
Maybe what's not digital display? Search.
Yeah. Search.
Is the simple answer.
Is that true? Is that really it?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, display is any... It's banners, it's rich media, it's video, it's sponsorships.
Okay.
It's pretty much all major forms of social advertising.
Okay. So that would include native,
video... It's native, it's video.
Stories.
It's stories... Over the top, anything IP delivered over the top would be display as well.
But it wouldn't include any kind of influencer stuff, probably.
No.
Right.
It wouldn't.
Yeah, got it. Cool. And when we think about areas of digital display that are not programmatic, so 86% is programmatic, 14% is not. Who are the holdouts?
Who's holding out?
And at what point does that number stop shrinking and there's a fixed 10% maybe that's never going to be programmatic?
I do wonder that every time our team updates the forecast. Yeah. Where's that cap, right?
Right.
Is it 90%? Are we going to inch over 90%?
Yeah.
You know, are we going to hit 100? We're not going to hit 100.
Right.
I don't think that's realistic. But, you know, how high will we get? In terms of the holdouts, I think at this point, it's campaigns that are really custom or bespoke, things that are just hard to automate the process with. I think there are also sellers or, you know, content owners who at this point are small and probably aren't engaging or using programmatic because it just doesn't make sense to invest in the tools and technology. There's a clearly not a huge portion of the population, but that applies to this, you know, 14% that we still won't see using programmatic next year. And even in the in-app space, we do hear that while it's changed, you know, that was definitely an area where there was holdout on the programmatic front.
Of all places
I know,
where
of
there
all
wouldn't
places.
Be holdout.
Right.
That makes zero sense.
Well, that...
Am I going to fax an ad insertion order to an app owner?
I think for some of the apps, it's either they have so little inventory, it just doesn't make sense to integrate with all the technology. And in other cases, they wanted full ownership and control.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Losers. Just kidding. So a big part of your the report is about what you could call private deals. So programmatic advertising that is not open exchange and not real-time bidded. And this is an area that gets very confusing very fast, where people think they're talking about the same thing, but they're not.
Yes.
So could you talk for a minute about what are the types of private
Sure.
Transactions and like how you think about them at eMarketer.
Sure. So when we look at non-real-time bidding, non-open market programmatic, because there are forms of private real-time bidding deals, mm-hmm. we consider that private marketplace. Mm-hmm. When we think about the non-open markets, there's the PMP or private marketplace and the programmatic direct buckets for us. Those are the two categories that we put things into. Mm-hmm. PMP or private marketplace is essentially private exchange. It's right. still real-time bidding. It's still exchange enabled. There's just some sort of a private deal that's going on. Mm-hmm. The other piece is the programmatic direct. And essentially that's where automation is present and real-time bidding is not. Social, for example, a lot of that is transacted through APIs. That's a huge chunk of the programmatic direct pie. Mm-hmm. And then programmatic guarantees would also be another piece of that.
Okay, so we're going to take a moment's break here from a sponsor. I'll be right back with Lauren Fisher. Hi, this is Zach Rogers, and I'm joined by Alex LePage, VP of Product Marketing with our sponsor, Neustar. Alex, welcome.
Thank you, Zach.
So tell us about Neustar Marketing Solutions and what you do.
Sure. We joke that we are the best MarTech provider you've never heard of. A bunch of serious data scientists and statistic nerds who make the best identity-based solutions for large, sophisticated B2C brands, B2C marketers. And basically to help them do better marketing. We've been working on regression models long before it was cool, we like to say. Mm-hmm. And Neustar sits in, a relatively unique spot in the MarTech landscape. Our entire aim is really to provide marketing intelligence to those brands. We don't buy or sell media. Essentially what we do is provide software as a service. We can talk about some of those solutions, as well as people and professional services to help marketers better communicate with customers. The other unique part of what we provide is really the combination of essentially offline pieces that we help make CRM systems and the offline component of marketing better. We have a DMP, and then we also have attribution and analytics, and that's all in one platform and all tied together by an underlying identity framework.
Okay, thank you. Now, talk a little in a little more detail, if you wouldn't mind, about the categories of solutions you provide. Could you just break them down?
Yeah, sure. So the first one, we call it customer intelligence. I mentioned sort of the CRM aspect. Every major marketer brand has a database full of customer records, and traditionally called it a CRM. What we found is that database is always substantially incorrect in terms of the data. The data is flawed, whether it be old and outdated, whether it be, there are a lot of duplicate information or not really reflective of the total information. So data lives in silos, right? And so what we do is essentially help clean that up, enrich it, make it better. Because we believe that first-party data that the customer, that the client has, really is their competitive advantage, and you want to start with that when you're thinking about marketing. The second major component is the identity DMP. Most of us have a loose understanding of what a DMP does, but essentially it helps to align all the data, in a digital for digital purposes, to be able to then basically segment and target across all the digital landscape. Ours is unique, as I mentioned, because we've literally built the identity graph into the DMP such that you're not just then doing digital marketing to a cookie or to a device ID, but you are actually, the customer and the customer record against that would reflect both the digital aspects of that customer journey, but also the offline piece. And then lastly, that leads to really our analytics solution. That's commonly known as a multi-touch attribution, MTA solution, and then a media mix modeling solution in MMM. You know, essentially what those do is they use statistical regression models to measure, in the case of when you put those two things together, literally measure everything, not only the activities that we spend money on as marketers, but also brings in external impacts like weather, economy, et cetera, to basically be able to tell the finance department and the CMO what they did worked and how to, you know, make it better.
All right, terrific. And so when you're having a conversation with the CMO, what are the challenges they articulate to you and how do you help them solve those?
Yeah, great. You know, the biggest are, number one, how do you make sense of the ever-proliferating data and myriad channels and devices, right, that we now, you know, have access to engage with the marketer? And so how do I decipher all that? And how do I actually construct a proverbial customer journey? A lot of people say that they're doing that today. It's really difficult to do, given all of the different data and the different channels. The likely, you know, follow-up question then is, okay, so now I've got all that data assimilated and I understand it to a certain extent. What do I do with it? How do I harness it to then really engage with people on their terms to really... you know, fulfill the promise of sort of a customer engagement in which the customer would like and actually prefer and would like to respond to the brand's messages and to their advertising. And then, you know, sort of last question is then I need to be able to measure that and, you know, and understand what worked and continually make that better.
All right. Terrific. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I'm back with Lauren Fisher from eMarketer. So we were just talking about private deals. Could you speak about what you see as driving just this rapid adoption of private deal types?
Sure. So when we're looking at the two types, private marketplace deals, we're definitely seeing increased focus there. As advertisers and even publishers to some extent just continue to want to have more control over their programmatic buying. Mm-hmm. They want to have someone on the other end so that if there's an issue with viewability, if there's an issue with fraud, if there's an issue with brand safety, you know, they can kind of hash that out and have this more one-to-one relationship. So we are seeing mm-hmm. that drive a lot of the private marketplace deals.
Okay.
Programmatic guaranteed. Another one where we're seeing growth with a lot of the premium mm-hmm. inventory that's coming into the digital pipes, video, connected TV, over the top. A lot of that we do believe will come in the form of guarantees. It's how it's transacted offline. It's how we believe it's going to come into the digital video and programmatic pipes. And then, of course, you know, that social piece, social's still growing. Social's still important, and we do believe that will drive growth as well.
Okay. So there's a few different things there.
Sure.
The first group of emotives was about really safety and trust.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you think that technology solutions to those some of those problems, fraud, brand safety, viewability. I mean, there have been advances on the technology front.
There have.
That are making it safer to buy open exchange without fearing your audiences not there or the wrong audience. Do you suppose that with those technology solutions, there may be a shift in budgets back to open RTB as people just feel more comfortable that that's an environment that they can trust?
It's a great question, and it's one that I've talked a little bit about at past programmatic IOs as the larger outstanding question of, you know, if we get it right, if we get transparency and viewability and fraud to a point where it isn't as much of an issue, you know, will that money move back into the open markets? Truthfully, I don't know. I think there's a lot that would need to happen to get buyers and sellers to the point where they'd feel comfortable enough to just continue to put it back into the open markets. The other thing you need to remember as it stands now, a lot of what's beneficial for some of these private deals is that you're getting a premium data asset along with it. a publisher's not going to put their first party data into the open markets. They'll make it available in a private marketplace or in some sort of a programmatic guarantee.
I see.
So I think that's another huge factor and piece of this puzzle that's keeping a lot of the spend where it is for now in the more private type setups and driving additional spend into some of these more private deals.
Okay, got it. And, you know, with premium inventory, you know, just the scarcity question.
Mm-hmm.
As more and more of the fraudulent or wasteful inventory is kind of stripped out and more budgets shift into programmatic, do you think that scarcity mindset, I mean, I presume will continue to make forward deals, futures deals, more the standard? Fair to say.
With the premium inventory?
Yeah.
I don't see that going away.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a change in what we define or think of as premium?
I think it's been changing for a while. I think it is no longer just about the unit or the content itself, but also very much about the audience.
Yeah, because I mean, it always used to be just like a New York Times leaderboard.
Right.
And, you know, De Beers would buy it, and that's premium.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's more about the audience. Do you see that mindset shift?
Sure. I mean, look at some of the television and connected TV and over the top where they're getting top dollar CPMs, CPMs that are higher because they have that rich audience data.
Okay, great. Speaking of TV, let's talk about programmatic TV.
Sure.
Early innings, obviously. What can we know today about the rate of adoption of data-driven advertising approaches in television by marketers and the agencies?
So we know, we've seen studies that suggest that by and large, most buyers are testing this in some fashion. There was an advertiser perception survey that was conducted last year that found 80% of the marketers that they and media buyers that they polled said that they had tested advanced TV or programmatic buying, allocated some amount of money there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were different grades and amounts that, you know, they had the thresholds for how much did you allocate. But if you look at people who allocated at least 1% of their budget, it was 80%.
Mm.
So that's pretty significant, you know, suggesting that 4 out of 5 advertisers are at least testing the waters on advanced TV advertising or programmatic.
Okay. It feels like right now things are accelerating from the seller's point of view.
Definitely.
Like as we speak.
Yeah.
Last week we covered how AT&T and Turner
are letting
that sort of first party data, AT&T's first party data kind of flow into the Turner media inventory.
Right.
So suddenly that's targetable and measurable in a way that it wasn't, you know, in 2018.
Sure.
And so you see a big company like that can flip the switch and suddenly data and programmatic sort of availability appears. How do you factor that these kinds of moves into your forecast for programmatic TV? Because it just seems like it is moving fast. Some of these big experiments are going to be disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are actually could be very lucrative and really move the industry along quickly.
Right.
How do you even think about that?
How do we think about that? So this gets back to our methodology for forecasting. And again, you know, we're looking at the reported revenues for some of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
Is anyone going on record saying how much they're actually getting programmatically?
Mm.
We would look at something like that. We're definitely, you know, our forecasting team has these massive Excel documents where they're putting basically all of the pieces of information that they've amassed since the prior forecast into this document to weigh each little piece as they're looking at that, the model for the year when they're updating it.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of information would make it into it. But also, you know, we're looking, what are sellers doing, but what are advertisers doing? You know, is there quantitative data we can rely on? Is there qualitative data? And we're taking all that and just trying to understand how does this all fit together.
And you've got the additional complicating factor of what are consumers doing.
Well, that's true too, right? And that's also a piece of this puzzle.
When you have these early stage efforts, these initiatives.
Yep.
I mean, an example might be Verizon Go 90.
Yeah.
You guys had to make a guess about how Verizon would do in the advanced TV space. I'm sure you factor in Go 90, like 3-4 years ago.
I think it
was a huge bomb. So,
and it just really gets to how complicated this is.
Mm-hmm.
What does the addressability number look like in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a question we need to look at. because we know that addressability and programmatic and television are pretty tied together at this point, right? Mm-hmm. So all of these little pieces go into the larger forecast. I think for the 3 years we've been forecasting for programmatic TV ad spend in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Our first forecast, when it came to year two and we updated it, we definitely, you know, pulled back a little bit.
Right.
And a lot of that had to do with the fact that we just hadn't seen in that year span that the investment and adoption had really, you know, mm-hmm. met what we had expected from the forecast.
Consumer trends in television include the growth of subscription video on demand. And there's right now kind of, I would say, double vision in the television industry, where on the one hand, you have these low ad or no ad environments. People are getting very comfortable watching whole seasons of television shows without seeing a single commercial. Mm-hmm. And then you have a classic cable subscription where you have a lot of minutes per hour dedicated to ads.
Right.
I'm curious, you know, as SVOD gains more audience, does that impact your forecasts for what the traditional cable environments are able to do in terms of serving ads? Right now they are reducing their ad loads.
They are.
I presume that will happen more quickly, potentially.
It's possible. Mm-hmm. I think overall the story is that consumers are shifting to more digitally streamed content.
Right.
So that alone is affecting television advertising.
Mm-hmm.
With all of the SVOD, it's interesting though, because we do think over time that reduced or no ad-supported model probably mm-hmm. isn't sustainable for everyone.
Right.
And one of the things I talk about in my digital display trends report this year that's publishing in a couple weeks is this thought that, you know, at some point we're going to hit the cap for how much consumers are willing to shell out for subscriptions. So having completely, you know, subscription-supported models for all of these different players that are popping up long-term, I don't think is going to be the main path forward.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's also like Netflix's colossal losses, operating losses. And at a certain point, I agree with you, there's going to be ads flowing into these ad-free environments.
Yeah.
It's going to be a little bit of a tough wake-up call for consumers, I think. I guess we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Right.
Let's talk about the duopoly, which continues to be a duopoly.
Yep.
And yet, there are some little chihuahuas nipping at its heels.
I love that.
We've got Amazon.
Yeah.
And Snapchat and Oath and AT&T. What do you guys see in terms of the leaders in the digital ad business from a media platform standpoint?
Sure. So Google and Facebook, really, they're not going anywhere. For now, that's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon, as one of my colleagues, Nicole Perrin, talked about in the fall, is now the number three digital platform in the U.S.
Okay.
In 2018, about 4% of all U.S. digital ad spend went to Amazon. And by 2020, that share is going to grow to 7%.
Okay.
Now, it's a small share, right? That mm-hmm. doesn't anywhere come close to the mm-hmm. 56% share that
yeah.
Facebook and Google combined
right.
will have.
Right.
But nonetheless, that share is growing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that share coming from the duopoly? Is it coming from the other category? I think it's really coming a little bit from both.
Okay. Got it. And with Facebook and all their problems, does that cause you to like dial down your forecast for them?
It will remain to be seen.
It has not. You have not yet.
We have not yet. No. We'll be updating
right.
our forecasting for U.S. digital ad spend sometime in Q1.
All right, guys. You're going to hear it soon. Facebook mismanagement may or may not affect its opportunity in advertising. Any other dark horses that you see?
I'd be really curious for us to have this conversation in 24 months and see if some of the dark horses might come from the more traditional TV space.
Right. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, there's obviously some major companies and they're spending billions, more than they ever have, to try and reach digital audiences. So Disney, NBC, those kind of folks.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And as everything converges, it'll be interesting to see how the playing field kind of resets.
Yeah. Right. This in-housing trend, let's spend a minute on that before we wrap.
Sure.
Largely driven by sort of programmatic in the early years of in-housing. People realize, oh, I can buy media with software and my agency can be fired, or at least I can dial down their role.
Sure.
And save money. What's the future of in-housing from your point of view?
In-housing is an interesting trend for me. I think, truthfully, it's a bit of a frustrating trend for me because of that association with purely programmatic. Mm-hmm. When you have a lot of conversations about in-housing, like programmatic in general, you have to define what you're talking about when you say in-housing. It did initially start with a focus on programmatic, with a focus on, I want to have more control, I want to have transparency, I want to make sure that the cost structure aligns to what I'm looking for. What we're really seeing, though, and what I think the future of in-housing will look like, is that companies who are really embracing this and moving down this in-housing path are looking at this as a much more holistic practice. They're looking at the execution pieces of in-housing, so executing on programmatic or other media channels, but they're also looking at all of the data and insight strategy behind those executions. There's a lot that goes into campaign planning and strategy before you even sit down with a DSP to place your buy. And that is where in-housing is really moving. We're seeing that a lot of companies are realizing, oh, you know, this isn't just about having control and hands-on keyboard, but it's about understanding who my customer is, having access to that data, making sense of that data. Mm. And then inevitably the conversation floats back to, does it make sense for me to be the executor or executor of this media? Mm-hmm. And it might not.
Right.
You know, as you're looking more strategically at this, you might find that some of these pieces are best suited with people who have that skill set, okay, whether that's internally or external.
Gotcha. There's another reason that in-housing is a frustrating trend for people like us, like observers of the industry, mm-hmm, analyzers of it, reporters on it, which is that agencies who used to control the budgets, mm-hmm, were always willing to talk to press and analysts. And I will say that while I think in-housing is a fascinating trend, it has been a little bit difficult for me to get good information about how it's being done and what's going wrong and what's going right, because brands, large brands, are not motivated to talk to press. And I'm not sure if this is also true in the analyst and research world, but it's been really kind of tough, with a few very notable exceptions. Belinda Smith, EA, I hope you're listening. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get more brand marketers coming into the podcast studio, talking on the record to our reporters, just sharing. But as of right now, I'm afraid that their communications executives have pretty strict rules around what they'll say and who they'll talk to, whether they'll even do a meeting. And it inhibits our coverage of in-housing as a trend. I'm curious if you have any similar thoughts.
I do. I see what you're saying. And mm-hmm, I think it's an issue that stems from a few things. I think a lot of brands look at that as competitive intel.
Oh, definitely.
And if they share with you what they're doing and what isn't working, then they're giving away secrets to their competitors.
That's true.
So I think that is one of the big inhibitors to getting people to talk more openly about this. The mm-hmm agencies, they see it as thought leadership. They see it as promotion and press and, you know, essentially free advertising, mm-hmm, to talk about it all day long.
That's right.
But for the brands, it's something that's much more coveted and held close. I think the other challenge, too, is depending on whether or not you have relationships, direct relationships with those brands, if you send the general press person a request to talk about something about in-housing or programmatic, okay, you know, that PR person's going to look at that and say, I don't know what this is.
DOA.
And if I do know what that is, like, I don't know who handles this. So
yeah, it has to come down to personal relationships.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Definitely true. And
Incidentally, I just want to encourage all of our brand marketer listeners to call your agencies and just give that business back to them. Because the agencies really know how to do this better than you. I'm just kidding. Keep going. Just talk to us. All right. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. We're going to leave it there. Lauren, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Zach. It was so fun to be here.
And thank you, listener, for tuning in to yet another episode of this podcast. We'll see you next week.
Tune in next week to hear more from Neustar's Alex LePage about their leading identity-based marketing intelligence, or visit marketing.neustar/IDMP to learn more about how Neustar helps top brands build next-level customer journey-driven experiences. Produced by Bigfoot Music and Sound in New York City.